Basic Brewing Radio is sponsored in part by the American Homebrewers Association. Learn how to ferment mustard, make pickled peppers, and bake the best boule with a free copy of The Fermentation Kitchen by Gabe Toth. Use promo code KITCHEN to join or renew your American Homebrewers Association membership by September 30th to claim your free book, a $19.95 value. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing to download a free recipe from The Fermentation Kitchen to learn more about this limited-time offer. homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 1st, 2022. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby and I culminate our conversations about recipe development by strategizing the creation of a delicious dry stout. We'll walk through the process of envisioning this recipe from scratch. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And many thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters have already seen the video episode that I'm planning to post on Friday. It's about my cream ale fermented at basement temperature with Imperial's Kvaiking. I usually ferment Kvaik hot outside on the porch. But I decided to do something cool this time. Literally, it's a super simple beer and perfect for this time of year. Steve and I also shot three other episodes that same day. pale ale that Steve brewed with Kvaik, a mead that he made with Imperial's hybrid strain Capri, and a simple mead that I made from local honey that I flavored with tinctures and made Steve guess what they were. And I'm not going to tell you if he guessed or not. And we're planning more fun video stuff. Our friend Matt Giovannisi brewed the American Amber Ale that he and I collaborated on with his latest recipe development episode. And Matt's planning to send us some cans of his beer so that Steve and I can taste it for the video show and for the audio show, too. Really looking forward to that. Out of all those, I was really interested in tasting the mead that Steve made with the I-22 Capri from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. I don't think I'm spoiling things to say that Capri had no problems fermenting the honey must. And I'll save our tasting notes for the video episode in a few weeks. Steve is really proud of that mead, and rightfully so. I-22 Capri is a true genetic hybrid of two yeast strains, A38 Juice and A43 Loki. So an English strain and a Kvaik. It's not a blend where they're just mixed together in a bag. Nope, it's a true hybrid between the two. I brewed a hoppy no-boil beer with it, as you saw in the video show, and it was delicious. Just another example of innovation from Imperial Organic Yeast. With 200 billion cells in each easy-to-open package, I like to say my stir plate is dusty, because I don't use it anymore to make starters for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. And my airlocks are usually bubbling before bedtime. Ask your local homebrew store about I-22 Capri and check them out at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. Now, I'm talking to Chris Colby this week, author of the Homebrew Recipe Bible, Methods of Modern Homebrewing, and How to Make Hard Seltzer. Chris has a fun announcement coming soon, which you'll hear about here. So stay tuned. In the meantime, Chris and I put our brains together to formulate a recipe for a delicious dry stout. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
This is we've been talking on this recipe development series for a long time, and we kind of had the culmination of it with Matt Giovannisi several weeks ago when we talked about an American amber ale and actually sort of constructed a recipe right there, live on the spot. And so I want to do the same thing with you, and I asked you to pick a style. And what did you come up with?
I said dry stout.
Now, I with Matt, what I did was I went into the BJCP guidelines and I searched for, you know, American Amber Ale, and they had a category there. With this, I searched for dry stout, and there's not a specific category apparently for specifically for dry stouts. It doesn't seem like to me that it would be an obscure category or an obscure style.
You are correct.
So I don't know what's going on there. So what is it that you like about dry stouts?
I mean, a good dry stout is just it's just a great beer. If you ever had, you know, like a Guinness, like a good fresh Guinness somewhere, or Murphy Stout, or Beamish Stout. Or, you know, there are some, you know, American brew pubs have come up with a good dry stout. It's just a good, flavorful, well-balanced beer. Yeah, it's hard to describe.
Yet we will attempt to.
Yes, in gruesome detail.
Now there is an Irish stout, an Irish extra stout, a sweet stout, an oatmeal stout, a tropical stout, foreign extra stout, American stout. So there's, you know, there's lots of stouts listed. And I guess maybe would it be similar to an Irish stout, since you mentioned Guinness?
Yeah, I don't know or care what the BJCP says. I mean, here's the thing: if you're a homebrewer, you know what a dry stout is. You don't need someone else to make up some numbers and throw them at you. You know?
And when you say dry, how dry, and how does that affect the style?
They're generally low alcohol, around 4% ABV, so that the finishing gravity is fairly low. But on top of that, some of them are even like a little bit dried out a little bit further by using very fermentable ingredients, like just like a little bit of cane sugar, you know. So yeah, they're. I don't know if there's a, you know, in like wine, there's a scale of dryness, and you know there isn't in beer, but you know it's a dry beer. It's a beer that when you know it smells of the roast malts that are nice, and when you taste it, It's roasty, and it's not sweet. It's not cloying. It's, you know, the opposite of those things.
So if it's low alcohol and finishes low in gravity, does it mean that there's a risk that it could be perceived as thin or watery?
If you do it wrong, sure. You can, especially if the pH is all wrong. You know, if your pH is low, there's a particular taste for dark beers that the pH hasn't been, you know, the water chemistry hasn't taken care of the pH, and there's specific taste, and one that does have the edge of thinness, whereas I'll use Guinness as an example because that's something that probably everyone has had. You know, Guinness draft, although it's a, you know, roughly 4% ABV beer, it's got a relatively, you know, full-bodied flavor. Not quite, because it's just a dry stout, but, you know, it doesn't taste like a Berliner Weiss or anything where there's, you know, the very thin body.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm assuming that, does that mean, and we may be getting ahead of ourselves, but does that mean that you have to pay extra attention to water chemistry?
Yeah, we should talk about water chemistry definitely when brewing a dry stout, because it definitely matters.
So maybe we should start there. Maybe we should start with water chemistry. And
sure.
And how do the ingredients affect that water chemistry? You know, does the ingredients in a dry stout, do they help or hinder with your water adjustments?
Well, as you probably know, if you take a pale malt and you just mash it with distilled water, your pH is going to be too high. And, you know, to help that out, you would add some calcium in the form of usually calcium sulfate or calcium chloride, and that would help the pH drop. In dark beers, you have actually the opposite problem, because darker malts are acidic on their own. When you look at the pH of a mash made with just pale malt versus just pale and, like, say, a medium crystal, the medium crystal is going to drive the pH down a little bit. And if you have a darker crystal, it's going to drive it down even more. And for roasted malts, the kind that go into, like, stouts or porters, they drive the pH down even further, although not proportionally to their color. Like, for example, a 300 Lovibond, roasted barley is not going to be 10 times as acidic as a 30 Lovibond crystal malt. But in any case, they do drive the pH down. And the pH, if you've got normal brewing water already with calcium in it, which you should, because the calcium does some other things other than help modulate the pH, your pH of your mash is going to be low, then the boil is going to drive it even lower, then the fermentation is going to drive it even lower, and it mutes the presentation of the roasted malts. Like when you go to smell the beer, it doesn't smell, it smells a little closed off. It's hard to describe, but just the roasted doesn't come through nice and strong. Whereas if you're in the right pH window, which is, it's fairly wide. It's not like you have to hit some, entirely narrow target, but if you're in the right range, your beer will just smell very, very roasty and in a very pleasant way.
And what's the range that we're shooting for?
You basically want, when you finish your boil, it would be nice if the pH was around 5. And then from there, so if it's 5.2 in the boil, in the mash, or between 5.2 and 5.4, so anything in there is pretty good. But then the boil will drive it down to about 5. And, from there, the fermentation should, not push the, at that point, shouldn't push the pH too low.
Yeah, I guess I should probably, like a lot of things, I should probably pay more attention to pH in my beers. But unless I'm, doing like a kettle sour or something, I usually don't. Do you take pH readings every time you brew?
Pretty much, yeah. I've got one of those little handheld pH meters. And, I was a chemistry. One of my undergraduate majors was chemistry, so... taking the pH is something that I would do. Really, once you've done it a few times, you could skip it on some brew days, because it's, if you're adding the same amount of, if you're treating your water the same way and you're using the same recipe for the beer, it should be fine, but never hurts to check.
Sure. Now with Matt, the American Amber Ale example, I had Matt actually go into the brewing software that he uses, to kind of build the recipe as we went along. And, we talked about the numbers that he was seeing on the screen, as we went. You use brewing software, but it's one of your own design, right?
Yeah, well, it's a spreadsheet, yeah, and I made it myself. I've also got beer... I can't remember. I've got one of the commercial software packages too. And it's cool, but it's just, when I've done my own spreadsheet, I know what exactly the spreadsheet is calculating and how to, if I want to not muck with it, I know how to do it.
Yeah, there's lots of examples or lots of different brewing software out there for, free and paid, and different, yeah. Different levels of benefits, whether you pay or not. But it's all kind of similar. it all adds up to the same.
if you don't pay for it, all the recipes come out as brown ales.
Just a little, another little dig at the brown ales. Our sponsors and friends, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies in Vermont, say the fall seasonal Wild Hunt is shipping very soon, maybe by the time you hear this. Wild Hunt is a balanced blend of honey, cranberry, blood orange, and spice, brewed in honor of the ceremonial meads of 18th century Northern Europe. At 6.2% ABV, it's deliciously drinkable. And if you search for Wild Hunt on Groenfell.com, you can find a homebrew recipe, too. So pick up some 4-packs of Wild Hunt cans, make the recipe yourself as well, and compare the two. Ricky and Kelly love to support home brewing and home mead making, including posting extensive advice and clone recipes on Groenfell.com. So cool. In addition to Wild Hunt, as of this recording, Bourbon Barrel Aged Veneer is still available, very limited. And on the other end of the ABV and flavor spectrum, you can get the delicious honey spritzers as well. Free shipping across the country to most states for orders over $75. That's it. Family-owned and operated, Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell. So do you have your spreadsheet open right now, Ian, as we speak?
I do, in fact.
So let's start with some base malt. What do you prefer using as a base malt, and how much would you start with on a 5-gallon or a 19-liter batch?
Well, you've got a lot of options. I mean, the super easy one would be to pick a pale ale malt. You know, that's a British malt. You know, for an Irish beer. You know, and it gives a nice malty flavor. It's kilned, you know, slightly darker than pale malt, although an English pale malt is fine. But, I mean, this is incredibly unhelpful, I realize, when I say this, but you can also use American two-row. You can also use Pilsner malt. I mean, just any pale malt that tastes good to you, that can be the basis. If you want, you know, a hint of authenticity, an English or British two-row pale ale malt, it is a great start.
And I guess if, you know, the darker the base malt, the less you have to work on the back end as far as adding specialty malts to get the color that you want.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between a pale ale malt and a pale malt is usually like 2 to 3 Lovibond. You know, pale malt is usually 2, pale ale is 3. So it's not really, you know, your color is going to be almost entirely driven by the roasted malts in this. So from a color standpoint, it doesn't really matter. But just from the standpoint of you want, even though the roasted malts are going to be prominent, you're still going to taste the base malt in there. And just so anything that has a nice flavor, and you know, if you want to go with a nod towards tradition, then I'd go with a pale ale malt. But really, any base malt that you enjoy, the or blend of base malts. Like if you wanted to do Pilsner with like a little bit of Vienna blended in, that could be perfectly fine. It's just, you know, what you like and what you enjoy.
Sure. So what do you want for this recipe that we're building? What do you choose, and how much? And I'm assuming that, you know, like usually when I brew, you know, like a 5% or around a 5% beer, 5-gallon batch, it's like 10 pounds of the base malt is what I start with, or 4.5 kilograms of the base malt. So since this is going to be lower gravity, you know, how much base malt should we start with?
Well, if you go by the 10, you know, equals 5, then 8 should equal 4. So let's try, if I type in 8 pounds of pale malt in here, what gravity does it give me? 1040, which, yeah, is going to end up with, an ABV here, assuming that attenuation gives me 3.8. So that's ballpark of what we're shooting for.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what's your base malt? What's your pick?
Just pick a pale malt, pale or pale ale malt.
Okay, all right.
And there are, I mean, there's, if you want to get really finicky about it, I mean, there's different maltsters in Britain, and all their pale ale malts don't taste exactly. So, you know, you can, it's, for someone who's like really into it, you know, you might want to try to get your hands on a variety of different malts. But for a beginner, just anything that's labeled British pale ale malt, you know, they all share enough similarities that you're not going to go wrong.
Mm. And then I'm assuming that since this is a stout, that roasted barley comes into it.
Yeah. Generally, I mean, a stout, if you're brewing a Guinness style stout, yeah, roasted barley is the main, in fact, the only roasted grain in that. And one interesting thing, of course, that you have to mention when you mention roasted barley is it's not malted. It's roasted unmalted barley.
Right.
And that gives, there's a very distinct aroma that comes with beers you brew that differs from roasted malt at the same level bond, and also difference in colors in the head or foam. You know, like roasted barley gives a fairly light colored foam, whereas roasted, you know, black malt or roasted, you know, roasted barley at the same level bond gives a sort of tan, orangey head. Huh. So, yeah, kind of interesting. And then there's for other stouts, you know, there are a lot of stouts that don't have, I mean, Guinness has a kind of, in a way, a sharp flavor. You know, it's very, that one malt is very, or that one grain is very prominent. Whereas others, like Murphy Stout, has a little more sort of balanced, and maybe also a little more intensity, or I'm sorry, a little less intensity in the grain bill, and that is from a blend of different dark grains, different roasted grains. And, you know, an interesting thing about the very darkest grains, like chocolate malts, which sort of run the gamut in color, and then roasted barley and roasted malt, or roasted malt or black malt, those all blend really well. Like, I do... you know, I've brewed a variety of porters and stouts, and a lot of them have all three of those in there just blended to a different consistency. Like if I'm making sort of a Guinness style stout, it's going to be very heavy on the roasted barley and, you know, very little roast malt, very little chocolate, you know, maybe like 14 ounces of roasted barley and then maybe like 2 of black malt and maybe like 1 of chocolate or, you know, something like that. It doesn't have to be that exactly. So they all blend together. And then if I'm doing something more like a porter or like if you ever had Sierra Nevada Stout before they changed the formula, that was all, if I recall right, that was all black malt. And that had a very distinct flavor. And so if I'm doing something like that, you know, it's the flip side of that, you know, maybe 14 ounces of black malt and then a couple ounces, you know, total, you know, 2 or 3 of a mixture of the chocolate and the other. Whereas if I'm brewing a kind of stout that's, you know, more Murphy's like, I bump the chocolate malt up quite a bit. Not maybe to equal the amount of the roasted barley or roasted malt, but, you know, a healthier percentage of that gives it, in my mind, a more rounded flavor, and also one more that, because I liked Murphy's Stout. I can't seem to find it anywhere anymore here, but yeah, it's a good dry stout.
Now, is there a difference in fermentability between roasted barley and a roasted malt of the same color?
In both cases, you're not really getting much extract out of them. You know, they're not contributing very many sugars. They've been roasted to the extreme. So if there is, it's tiny, and, you know, on a homebrew scale, I wouldn't worry about it. I never have, at least. Maybe I should.
And,
and I like learning about stuff. I don't want to relax, have a homebrew. I want to get out a spreadsheet and look over every aspect and worry about every last thing and try to do it right. But that's just me.
You need to make your own bumper sticker. No, I've always said if it makes you happy to stress up, just, you know, to sweat the details and stress out about stuff, then do that. Yeah. You know, because there are some people that, you know, they wouldn't be happy if they did something, you know, in a slapdash way. You know, it would make them stressed out.
Yeah, for some people that's the fun of it. And actually, when I look at my spreadsheet here, I do list black malt as having 1 point gallon per pound more in extract than roasted barley, 25 for roasted barley and 26 for black malt.
Oh, well, there you go.
Also, sometimes people don't say point gallon per pound, but say points per pound per gallon, which is, you know, it's like a fraction with three levels, which is not how you do it. Just why I simplify it to point gallons per pound.
And I'm assuming, since this is a dry stout, that crystal malts are right out.
Well, that's an interesting point. In dry stouts that have, well, in like Guinness doesn't have any crystal malts, but Murphy's did, not a lot. In the example that I put in my book, Homebrew Recipe Bible, it has 2 ounces of caramel malt in it at 80 Lovibond. So for a 5 gallon batch, that's just a little, but you actually notice it because there's, you know, you taste the roasted barley and that's sort of on one plane. And then you taste the base malt, which is on another. And then, but you can taste a little bit of, you know, a hint of caramel in there, just like you can in Murphy's. And, So that's, again, it's a good point in that you're trying to brew a dry stout. So like the more and more like crystal or caramel malt that you add, the more you're sort of working against the dryness of the beer.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways around that. Of course, you can add, for example, like in the one I have in the book, I add there's 12 ounces of sugar, just cane sugar, in the beer too. And so that, you know, more than counteracts the 2 ounces of caramel malt in there.
Yeah.
Whereas in like a Guinness, you wouldn't. It would just be the pale malt and then the roasted barley and then just a reasonably low temperature mash, you know, within the normal saccharification range.
Okay. So let's hit the spreadsheet. We got 8 pounds of our pale malt in there. What are we going to add, and how much of the specialty malts and or grains?
I'd say let's add a blend of roasted barley, roasted malt, and chocolate malt.
Okay.
Maybe like just for an initial spitball here, let's go with 12 ounces of roasted barley at 500 Lovibond. So 16. So that's 0.75 pounds of roasted barley. And let's go with like let's go with 3 ounces of chocolate malt at like 350 grams chocolate malt. So that's about 20 or roughly 0.2 pounds. Or 3 ounces of chocolate malt at 350. And then just for the hell of it, let's put in 1 ounce of black patent malt.
Oh.
There we go. So we've got 14. So we got a pound of dark malt for a 5 gallon batch, or a pound of roasted malt for a 5 gallon batch. And that's about right for a stout. Overwhelmingly roasted barley, little bit of chocolate malt to round things out, and a little bit of black patent just to additionally to round things out just a little bit more.
So how are you going to handle those dark grains in the mash? Do you, I mean, do you put them in the mash, or do you do something else with them? There are some decisions that you got to make there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways people futzed around with dark, dark beers, and one of them is to mash the pale malts all by themselves, and then stir in the dark grains at the end. I like to have the mash as a whole, just mash everything in at the same time and just have the water chemistry worked out. I think it's actually, from a water chemistry standpoint, it's harder to do it the other way, because you need to get the pale malt. If you're doing it, a pale malt mash, then you have to have the water chemistry right for that. But then you've got to think of the water chemistry on the dark malts, that when they're blended in, that then it's all, coming out okay. And then, it takes time for all the minerals to sort of dissolve. Some of the carbonates that you would use are slower to dissolve. So yeah, I just mash it all together.
Mm.
I will on occasion grind the grains separately, because dark grains, given how long they're roasted, and then they're usually started, or sometimes started from smaller kernels as well. They're smaller, and it's easier for them to just sort of run through the mill without getting crushed. And so some home brewers, and sometimes, depending on how lazy I feel or not, will tighten up the mill gap and run the dark grains through, and then loosen it up to where, their normal setting for pale grains.
And one benefit of doing the dark malts first, or the dark grains first, is that, then you could run your lighter colored pale malt through there and kind of clean your mill. So a little bit of practical advice there.
A bit of practical. One thing I definitely don't do, and I see this recommended a lot, is some people additionally, like, they quote-unquote cold steep their roasted grains, or I've seen this one, coffee beers too, and my opinion, which is of course strident and obnoxious, is that if you don't, because they always say, well, this mellows them out or makes them smoother. It's like, if you don't like roasted things, don't put roasted things in your beer. Don't take like coffee or roasted malts and then do a cold water extract of them, which doesn't extract the parts that they've been specifically roasted for. Just use like a lower level chocolate or skip it altogether, but that's just me.
I think the only time that I remember doing a cold steep, or wasn't even a cold steep. I did a hot steep of some darker specialty grains. I think Steve and I were doing a party guile, and so therefore we didn't want to put the dark grains in the main mash. Because, then we would be limiting ourselves to both having dark beers, essentially. So we did the main mash separately. He took the first runnings, I think. Anyway, we split it up, and then I did a separate steep of the dark grains, and then poured them in my, poured the resulting water in my wort. But that's... Mm. That's neither here nor there. So what
I did a beer once that was like, it was like a stout or porter, but it was only like 5 to 10 times more roasted malt. It was like super concentrated, and the hopping was pretty high too, with the idea that I could take any pale beer I had, make about a 1 to 4 dilution, or 1 to 9, I can't remember, it was somewhere in there. And then suddenly you'd have like instant stout, and it needed some work. It's not a bad idea to start with, but the first run out the gate had some issues.
You mentioned hops. Are we ready to talk about hops?
Sure.
I'm assuming that this isn't a big, hoppy beer with hops in the whirlpool and in dry hops. And
a typical dry stout, it's not a super hoppy beer. Like Guinness has a sort of what they might call like a firm hop bitterness. Like, you definitely know there's hops in there, but not It's more in the bitterness than in the flavor and aroma. And Murphy's is toned down, a notch from that. But still, it's clearly a hopped beer. I would say, if you're making a Murphy's-esque dry stout, the hops you'd want, that's a good question. I would say between 30 and 35 IBUs would be a good start. That's a sort of pale ale range. Although without the late flavor, it comes across as less. The roasted malts have their own sort of bitterness to them. So the bitterness of the hops and the bitterness from the roasted grains sort of they should have a nice balance to them. You should be able to taste both things and have you might in a roasted, in a dark beer want the roasted malt flavors to be a little bit stronger, and that's great. But you want at least the hops. The hop bitterness is going to round out a little bit of the roast bitterness.
Yeah, that's a higher IBU level than I was going to guess. I was going to guess like in the 20s,
you can do that, especially in more of a Murphy's inspired stout. You could probably drop down into the 20s. I wouldn't go below like 25, but that's just me.
And would you add hops other than just like bittering at the beginning of the boil? Would you add some, any late hops at all?
That's a good question. I generally do when I brew like a Murphy's style. I put a very little in right around knockout, just sort of a mellow hop or a noble hop or something like. Something like if you can get your hands on decent Kent Goldings, a little bit of that aroma at the end is going to be good. Like not, you almost want the aroma of that. You definitely want the aroma of the hops to be like under the aroma of the roasted malt.
Right.
But a little bit, you don't strictly need it. If you're going just for like a Guinness, that's just bitterness and roastiness. And there isn't a lot of hop aroma in that.
And you mentioned EKG. Does it matter as much since you're only using hops for bitterness? Does it matter as much what hop you use?
Yeah, I think it does. I know I've heard a lot of people say like, "Oh, if you brew a dry beer or not a dry beer, but if you brew a roasty beer." It doesn't really matter what the bittering hops are. No one's going to be able to taste it. And I sort of disagree. It's the varietal character of the bittering hops in a roasted beer are going to be obscured a bit because there's the roasted flavor, which, is sort of competing. But you can tell. And I would say just use any, you take your brewing experience and think about, what the characteristics of various bittering hops are and say, just think like, would this work well with a roasted beer?
Mm.
Like for my porter, I use Northern Brewer because that has, or it's described as having a sort of minty character to it.
Mm.
And it kind of sort of does. Although not, it's not really a spearminty, a pepperminty, that kind of thing, but there's a minty word and that works well with roast. So like Northern Brewer is one of my favorite hops to use with a porter. And for dry stouts, basically any relatively neutral high alpha hop would work well. I tend to use the English versions just because it's an English beer, but you could use like Magnum or something or you could pick an American variety of high alpha hops as long as it's not super piney or that doesn't have a strong varietal characteristic that's going to seem out of sorts in a in a dry stout.
Steve and I are planning to attend the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational on Saturday, September 10th, in the parking lot of our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave of HighGravityBrew.com. Susan and I went last year, had a blast, and recorded a show there, you may remember. It's incredible how far Oklahoma craft beer has come. You'll find delicious beers at the festival, including Eleanor Eve Saison, a table saison brewed with juniper berries, from Welltown Brewing, Dog Soldier Double IPA from Skydance Brewing, and Prickly Heat Blonde Ale with prickly pear puree and green chilies from Pippin's Tap Room at High Gravity. And while you're in the parking lot, you can check out the extensive inventory inside at High Gravity, including the fabulous Warthog Electric Systems. You can find tickets to the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational at TCBI Beer. And as always, you can find Desiree and Dave's awesome store at HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com. In the spreadsheet, let's go traditional. What do you say we use something like East Kent Goldings?
Sure.
And what's the alpha acid listed? I mean, it's gonna vary, you know, planting. Yeah, well, you know,
Goldings are usually right around 5.
Yeah. So, I mean, year by year, it's going to, in location, you know, where you buy them and where they're from and all that stuff, it's going
to
differ. Refer to your packaging.
Yes.
So how much would you put in for?
So just typing in as a starter, one ounce at 5 gets us just short of 20.
Oh.
So let's try 1.5 and see where we get. What's that?
And an ounce, okay. An ounce is 28 grams.
Yeah.
Apologies.
No worries.
For people in the sane world.
42 and a half grams. It's the same as 1.5 ounces. Yeah, and that gets us to 28 IBUs, which, you know, that's ballparking it. That's pretty good.
Yeah. I've gotten to where I like to use a whole, unless I'm doing a small batch. You know, for 5 gallon or 19 liter batches, I tend to use whole ounce increments just because, you know, I'm sick of having like 20 half used or bags of hops in the freezer that are just going to go bad after a while.
2 ounces gets us to 37.
Oh, that seems a lot.
That's a little too high.
Yeah, that seems a lot. Maybe you could put that extra half ounce in at the end of the boil, or like 10 minutes before the end of the boil or something.
Yeah. Or if you go 1.75 ounces, which is essentially 50 grams, that gets us to 32. And then, you could use that last little bit at the end of the boil.
Yeah.
2.5 and 5. There we go.
There you go. Wow. We're being thrifty.
And we should go back. Dial down the amount of pale malt because we're at 40. Let's see, we're at only an OG of 43, which gives us 4.2%. That's not bad. It's a little heavier than 4, but very little. I mean, it's not brain surgery.
That works.
Shouldn't be. Yeah.
And then yeast, a nice Belgian yeast, right? Hefeweizen yeast.
Kvik yeast. Yeah.
Well, Kvike might work, actually. No, it's not. Well, I don't know. It depends on what temperature you ferment at. I did a cream ale. This is a spoiler for the video podcast, but I did a cream ale that I fermented in my basement with Kviking from Imperial at 72 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 22 C. And boy, is it clean. It took 4 days to ferment as opposed to, you know, like one or two, which is, I usually ferment Kvike out on the hot porch at 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 C. But fermenting the Kvike at a cooler temperature, really, it was super, super clean.
Hmm.
That's neither here nor there. But anyway, so I'm assuming a British ale yeast.
that will do a great job. I mean, one nice thing about fermenting a dry stout is with the low ABV, the yeast, if you pitch in a normal amount, you aerate reasonably and hold the fermentation temperature in either the sort of mid-range or high mid-range, you know, or slightly above that, of the yeast fermentation profile, it's gonna perform very well. It's not gonna be stressed. And really, all you need to do is pick a strain that gives you the ester profile you want. You know, if you want sort of very clean, yeah, you could use something like a you know American, 1056 or US05 or WAP001. You know, the Chico strain. And if you're looking for more, esters, just look for any, you know, British ale strain that has good attenuation. You know, if you're going to use like the Fuller's strain, which is, you know, WLP002 or 1968, that's probably not the best choice for the stout because that tends to drop out early. But pick a, you know, there's a White Labs strain called, you know, Dry English Ale. And that's sort of like, well, you know.
Oh, well.
Problem solved.
That's a bit on the nose.
Yeah.
If Steve were here, he would have made an Esther Williams joke by now, but that's
are you... also, I mean, they used to, White Labs and Y Yeast used to and probably still do have, you know, Irish ale strains. And, you know, again, I've never actually used those, but yeah, you know, I'm sure you can't go too far wrong with that. But just, yeah, pick a British strain that you like and delivers an amount of esters that you think are going to work well in a dry stout. You know, a little bit of a fruity estery aroma is good. Like too much is just sort of wrong. And then you will have a very nice fermentation. Just, you know, if you make the appropriate size yeast starter, the low gravity of the beer, you know, the fermentation will go, you know, just perfectly.
And fans of the podcast are wanting me to say, you know, that I haven't used my stir plate to make a starter in a while because, you know. I would pick a yeast strain from Imperial Organic Yeast, but the, you know, I have they're sponsors of the show.
Sure.
And I'm really happy with them. So what else? I mean, we already talked about water. You gave me a cheat sheet here, and you listed under other, you listed some ingredients that if we want to take this dry stout, you know, and ramp it up a bit into something else, we could play with some adjuncts.
Yeah, if you want to take the dry stout and make it a, you know, some, you know, adjective dry stout, you know, or something else mixed with dry stout, you've got all sorts of, you know, anything that works well with roast, you know, so you could make a coffee dry stout by adding a little bit of coffee. You could make a chocolate dry stout by adding some, you know, cacao nibs. You could add a little bit of brewer's licorice in there, which, you know, and you can either tell people it's there or just it can be another flavor that adds some interest, but, you know, maybe it's not really easy to identify. Fruits like cherry and raspberry do really good, and you could do a cherry or raspberry dry stout. The sort of challenge there is that the cherries and raspberries are going to taste a little better with more residual sweetness in the beer. And of course, in a dry stout, you don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
You can add bacon to a dark beer.
dry porking.
Yeah, dry porking. Yeah, we discussed that. I want that. But on the normal beer, a couple things that people should look into is one of the things that you want to do is collect the correct amount of wort when you brew this. Ours we got up to about 9 pounds. But if you're going a little bit lower in the overall pounds of malt, you want to make sure to check your pH as the as the runnings are coming off and cut it off when those drop too low. Mm. And because otherwise you'll get astringency in your beer. And what can happen with a low enough gravity beer, the amount of wort you collect can actually be less than your target volume.
Mm.
And in that case, you need to add, you know, if you end up with, say, only 5 gallons of wort and you're trying to make a 5-gallon batch, you'll have to add, like, another gallon of water, and then, you know, that'll get the boiled away in the boil. So that's another thing to think about. And the final thing I would say is carbonation in dry start or nitrogenation is going to influence the beer a lot.
Mm.
You know, Guinness a while ago introduced those little widgets in their beer, and they've always had the nitro, you know, stouts on tap. And a lot of people think that, like, you need that in a dry stout. And in fact, Murphy's actually started putting their beer in cans and with a widget in it. And I thought that made the beer worse.
Oh.
I like the old, like, in maybe I'm just a grumpy old man.
Maybe.
Maybe about it. But, like, back when I was in graduate school, we used to go to this bar, and they had Murphy's, you know, and back then it was in bottles. And, you know, it was just ordinary carbonation, and it was a great beer. And then, I don't know, to me, the nitrogenated version of it with the widget is just makes it too namby-pamby. It sort of cuts all the, because it was never like as an aggressively roasty beer as Guinness, but it was still a stout. You know, it was still, you know, had those nice roasty flavors with sort of notes of coffee and all that. And to me, I just didn't like that. So, so you got to think about whether, you know, if you've got a keg set up, whether to just regular carbonation, or if you also have a nitrogen set up, which you're going to push it with. And then there's also the level of carbonation. And, you know, the standard, 2.5 to 2.6 volumes of CO2 that go into most American craft brews and also American lagers, you know, that'll work. But softening the carbonation just a hair, like dropping it down to like 2.4 or 2.2 volumes of CO2, can make it nice. It's a lower, you know, with the lower gravity overall and the lower finishing gravity, having it excessively fizzy can make it seem drier and thinner, you know. So a little bit of you know, it still needs to be carbonated, but just lowering the carbonation a little bit can help you get the balance right.
Huh.
And in fact, if you're kegging, you can do that on the fly. If you think it tastes a little too thin, drop the carbonation a little bit, you know, let it equilibrate and try it again. Or if you're like, this is too, you know, if you're at 2.4 volumes of CO2 and you think, well, this is, you know, could use to be thinned out a little bit, try bumping up the carbonation a little. It doesn't actually thin out the beer, but it changes the perception on the beer drinker's tongue.
Huh. Well, it sounds delicious. And if you want to find the official recipe that Chris put in his book, you can look for the Homebrew Recipe Bible. I'm trying to think of the. I always forget the other book. You had the seltzer book, the hard seltzer book, and then there's Methods of Modern Homebrewing. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Methods of Modern Homebrewing. That's right.
I remembered. Those cogs are a little rusty back there. Well, excellent. Anything more for the cause? Any other tips?
Trying to think. Oh, one like little thing I would say is that, you know, people, some of the malt names, like especially chocolate malt, you have to learn that the name of the malt, don't be overly influenced in your mind about what the name is. Like chocolate malt doesn't really particularly taste like chocolate.
Right.
Like it certainly doesn't taste like milk chocolate.
Right.
But it doesn't really even taste like cacao. I mean, it's it's roasted very similarly. And I mean, I, you know, it's all those roast flavors have similarities, but get to know your dark malt. If you're going to brew stouts and porters, get to know your dark malts, you know, just know what they smell like, know what they taste like, you know, maybe even just steep little bits of them in water and, you know, try a little bit of that. And it'll just help you, you know, it'll help you familiarize yourself with the grains individually, and that might help you make some decisions in recipe formulation.
Yeah, good advice. Excellent. Well, it's been a long time since we got together, and let's not wait so long next time. And you'll have to think about a style that you want to, you know, like develop a recipe for on the fly, and then we'll get back together and talk again.
Extra dry.
Stout. Extra dry stout.
Super extra dry stout.
Arid extra dry stout.
Yeah. It's like a powder. You just crush the grains and serve it in a glass. It's just the powder. It's so very dry.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks again to Chris. We're thinking something big to go into fall and winter with the next recipe formulation. Stay tuned for that. And as I said in the beginning, keep your eye out for a fun announcement coming from Chris before long. And I'll pass that on this show when it happens. If you have some brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.